Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Just so we'll go the format quickly, each of our panelists will give an opening remarks for about 5 minutes, and then we'll have a conversation amongst ourselves for about 20 minutes or so, depending on how it goes. And panelists, feel free to follow up on each other as you will. I'm hoping just to be sort of the keeper of the time. Then we'll open up for questions. And as was stated before, please no statements, just questions. And it'll be part of my responsibility to sort of land those statements if they happen to occur to get to a question. Our panelists will get started so we can end this session on time. To my left, to your right, Bridget Brennan. She's the Special Narcotics Prosecutor for New York City. Dr. Khalil Muhammad, Director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. Benjamin Tucker, Deputy Director of the White House Office on National Drug Control Policy. And William Burrell, former Chief of Probation Services for the State of New Jersey, the court system. He's a corrections management consultant. Ms. Brennan, let's start with you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm very grateful to be here today, and I'm grateful to be on a panel that's about America's addictions, because I think law enforcement has a critical role to play when it comes to an important public health issue, which is addiction. And make no mistake, addiction is a public health issue. The Supreme Court declared probably 50 years ago that you can't criminalize a status, that it's not a crime to be an addict. What is a crime and how law enforcement becomes involved is in the distribution of addictive drugs and in addressing all the crimes that typically accompany an addiction, from petty theft to cold-blooded homicides. My office has been around for about 40 years. It was first established during the heroin epidemic of the 70s. And at that time, heroin was a drug of choice. It was ravaging mostly minority communities here in the city. It was estimated at the time that a huge number of the country's heroin-addicted population lived here in New York, and whole generations of the South Bronx in Harlem. Many, many of those young men perished in this epidemic. As a matter of fact, in 1972, narcotics overdose was the leading cause of death for young people between the ages of 15 and 25. That was the dimension of the problem then. And the first response to it was a public health response. Governor Rockefeller helped push through something through the legislature, which allowed judges to mandate people to treatment. But it was a civil commitment. There was no way to keep them into addicts in treatment. And the project failed. It was a miserable failure and a costly failure. Governor Rockefeller declared it cost $750 million and there was no benefit. And then he pushed through what came to be known as the draconian Rockefeller drug laws, which have been repealed. And those laws had no real treatment component. It was just strict, stringent penalties. Now, eventually, the heroin epidemic waned, and then it gave way to the crack epidemic. And if we thought the heroin epidemic was bad, the crack epidemic was like nothing we had seen before in terms of the violence. The heroin addicts nodded out. The crack addicts went crazy. I was a homicide assistant during that time, and when the epidemic reached its height, I think in New York City, there were about 2,000 homicides that occurred in a single year. And just to give you a point of contrast, last year in New York City, there were about a quarter of that number. One of the worst precincts, the 3-4 precinct in Upper Manhattan, was a drug bazaar, and there were more than 100 homicides in a single year there. It was split into two precincts. Again, by way of contrast, last year combined, the now 3-4 and 3-3 precincts, there was a total of 5 homicides. The response to that problem was a huge enforcement effort. And it was, and I beg to differ with the governor of the state of Connecticut, but it was a response to a community plea for help. People were dying on the streets because the crack epidemic and the heroin epidemic were very different. The crack organizations were disorganized. They were fighting over street corners. It is not one monolithic problem. The problem is not all the same. It is not one war on drugs. There are many, many different addictions. There are different law enforcement challenges, and the tools have to be different. In response to that crisis, my office, along with a couple of other visionary prosecutors' offices, started an alternative to incarceration program where we were offering, here it was crack-addicted mothers, the opportunity to stay out of prison. They were selling crack. My office has jurisdiction only over cocaine, heroin, and now opiate prescriptions as well. But those are the narcotics crimes, not marijuana. We were offering crack-addicted mothers the opportunity to stay out of prison and put their families back together if they got into treatment, stayed straight, stayed sober, got their lives together. And we saw great successes. And judges opposed us in our efforts in this regard. Some of them felt that we were overstepping our authority. We had no authority to allow these women to stay out of prison if they stayed in treatment programs. But we forged ahead, and we got the support of judges. We got the support of many in the criminal justice community. And now you see the federal government supporting these programs, and the states have taken them over. And now we are facing a crisis of dimensions that I think will eclipse both of those crises put together, and that is the crisis of pain relief, prescription drug addiction. And you journalists, you are my captive audience. Please, please look at this issue in your own communities. I started to find oxycodone pills in search warrants with guns, with cocaine, with heroin. And then I tried to figure out what's causing this problem. And what did I learn? The number of prescriptions for opiate pain pills in New York City between 2007 and 2010 increased from 500,000 to over 1 million. Over 1 million, not pills, prescriptions filled. Doctors must be smarter in the way they prescribe. We must keep a closer eye on this. These addictions are fueling violent crime. My narcotics investigators who invested heroin crime in the 70s say they are seeing young kids nodding out on the corners in far larger numbers than they ever saw in the 70s. This is our new addiction, and public health has to take the front wheel on this one. These drugs are regulated drugs, they are closely monitored drugs, and yet they are being abused.
The users of opium were a wide swath of American society, including native-born whites in California. But opium became associated in the public's mind with opium dens in Chinatown. Therefore, the law enforcement response was to criminalize Chinese immigrants, and it became part of a larger context where native white Americans were threatened by the presence of Chinese immigrants in this country. That's example number one. The second example is, as the country incurred a larger concern about cocaine, for example, in the early 20th century, the early association of the dangers of cocaine were associated first with Southern blacks, and secondly, with the potential of cocaine to contribute to interracial sex on one hand and rape on another. So we all know the Jim Crow story. I'm not going to unpack it here, but make no mistake about it, and for you journalists who have access to LexisNexis, look it up. The point is that cocaine in the earliest cultural framework of this country was attached to the inherent threat that black people posed as Southerners. And indeed, the fear-mongering that attended to early federal legislation under the first drug czars, Edward Williams was one of them. Some of this stuff I can't remember off the top of my head. Dr. Hamilton Wright, was Southerners were deeply hostile to federal legislation, part of the context of the Civil War. So one way the Southerners were willing to go along with increasing federal crime control in the early 20th century was to use blacks as a scapegoat for a drug problem. That is to say that the federal government said, well, it's because of black people that we have to enhance our crime control policies, and Southerners signed off on it. Again, I would encourage you to read more about it. The final example that I want to use is marijuana. So we get the first attempts through the Treasury Department under Harry Anslinger, and later a kind of more robust federal law enforcement response to marijuana use. But the earliest anxieties about marijuana use were about its impact on middle-class youth. And I'll just throw out here a cultural reference point, just because many of you will know it, and it will simplify the patterns that I'm trying to demonstrate here. So Reefer Madness is, of course, most people know it as a 1970s cult film, but in 1934 is a very serious, moralistic account of the inherent threat that marijuana posed to our sort of backbone of our country, which were our middle class citizens. And the allusions to jazz music as the kind of cultural signpost for the threat. So it's a mostly white cast, right? They weren't explicit in racializing the cast of it. But the point is, the association of inner city with music, with speakeasies, was itself a context for broadening the racialization project that was just about to unfold. Now, the New York Times is covering marijuana dens that are in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, and the association of those supply links to Mexicans and Mexican-Americans and Mexican-Americans was made very explicit early on. So by the time we get to the 1950s, we've got the second great migration, we've got further urbanization of black communities, we've got white flight going up crazy all across the country. And what I'm emphasizing again in this short introduction is that you cannot talk about anything happening in the 1970s forward as if it's disconnected from a context, the infrastructure of this country, in terms of how it understands, how it popularizes, and how it focuses on race, whether it's explicit or implicit, whether it's proxy or whether it's very clear. So I will follow up with more comments in the conversation.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. So I want to talk a little bit this morning about the Obama administration's approach to drug policy and our efforts to reform our nation's drug policies in particular. It's already been discussed in terms of the complexity and the scale of the problem. So as I reflected on, as Jeremy mentioned this morning, the scope of this particular symposium, this conference, it occurred to me that I should talk a little bit about just sort of my perspective. And my perspective really is shaped by growing up in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy and sort of facing the challenges, firsthand and looking at the impact of Bridget mentioned the heroin addiction problem back in the 60s. And sort of as a kid and a teenager, sort of dealing with all the issues and challenges that young black men had to deal with in those days, were pretty daunting. And interestingly enough, and perhaps even there's some irony in this, I later became, when I graduated from high school, a New York City police officer. For me, joining the police department was about sort of educating what I believed at the time were police officers, particularly white police officers, who needed to, I thought, have a different perspective on the fact that not every young black kid was a kid that was involved in drugs and crime. And then I spent the next 35 years of my career, almost 40 years of my career, sort of in the field of criminal justice in a variety of positions. So from both a professional and a personal perspective, that's the lens through which I view the job that I do now at the White House. And it couldn't be more clear to me, as has been mentioned before, as it is to the administration, that we can't really arrest our way out of this problem. And that's, just a fact. And so I wanted to spend a little time just giving you the perspective of the administration on some of the costs, some of which we've talked about, but others have not. And so Department of Justice recently released data that shows that we spend $193 billion, roughly, a year on drug costs associated with the challenges we face in our society. $56 billion of those dollars can be traced directly to costs associated solely with our criminal justice system. And so, you know, you all know the facts, but they bear repeating. We have, you know, 7 million or so of our citizens in under criminal justice supervision. Of those, 5 million roughly are on probation or some type of parole, on parole or probation, and more than 2 million remain behind bars. Between, just to cut to the chase and keep things brief, the administration also strongly supports alternatives to incarceration, trying to so look at a variety of alternatives to deal with the complexity of the problem. So drug courts that we're all familiar with have been a success, but we are looking beyond those to more creative, more innovative approaches from policymakers and practitioners who are challenging the status quo, thinking about ways in which we can do things differently to address the challenge. For example, community supervision programs employing swift, certain but yet modest sanctions has been, for drug offenders on probation and parole, has been promising. As we've looked at that, particularly as it relates to high risk, those at high risk for reoffending. In other cases, as Jeremy mentioned this morning, we're thinking about and trying community-based strategies, which many of you are familiar with, for example, the drug market interventions, which focuses on working in communities, coming up with clear and predictable sanctions, and offering a range of community services to address the challenges, and also establishing community standards for acceptable behavior. At the same time, improving one of the main challenges that's sort of been a common theme throughout the history, particularly from the 60s on, and that is the whole notion and tension around police-community relations. And so we're trying to move on those things. So indeed, you know, there's a range of strategies that we've been focusing on. The Second Chance Act funding for programs that improve coordination of reentry services has been a high priority for the administration. We have a reentry council that's led by the Attorney General, by Eric Holder, and that we also have been meeting with state's attorneys general and been asking them to review their state laws as well to deal with and address some of the challenges that we face with respect to collateral consequences our folks who are being leaving prison and reentering communities have as they try to seek opportunities to begin getting their lives on track. So I'll stop there just to, you know, okay. I'm sure I'm over, but I wanted to just give you that framework. I look forward to the questions and answers.
Thank you, sir. Benjamin Tucker, also, sir, welcome home. You're a graduate of John Jay.
Yes, I am. Yes, this is John Jay. You have to know, when you look at this building, when I was at intended Jay, it didn't look anything like this. But it is good to be back. It's my alma mater. And you know, I attended this school while I was a New York City cop going to school at night, and it was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
Thank you, sir. Thanks. Thank you. William Burrell. Okay.
Thank you. I, too, am a John Jay graduate. I did my master's studies here. I was in the building Catty Corner on 59th Street, which I understand was an old shoe factory that they converted into a college, quite a bit different than where we are right now. As Ben did, I want to just give you a little bit of perspective from my background, the lens that I look at this issue through. I'm a career correctional practitioner, spent some time in academia, and now I'm a consultant to community corrections agencies. I like to say I'm a recovering bureaucrat and a recovering academic. I lived through the various iterations of the war on drugs, working in Newark, New Jersey for 5 years in the 1970s, and then ultimately as a state probation administrator. We lived through the war on drugs in the 1980s, so I saw it from both the line perspective on the street and then as an administrator. And, you know, we've talked about the addictions. We talked about typically the, you know, illegal drugs and alcohol, and then Bridget mentioned earlier, you know, the new addiction is to prescription drugs. And our response to substance abuse and alcohol abuse and addiction has been to use the criminal justice system as the tool to try to control, mitigate, and eliminate it. And using the criminal justice system as our principal tool has left us with another addiction, all right? this addiction is to the to punishment as our tool for dealing with addiction, and more specifically, an addiction to incarceration as a tool for dealing with addiction. And I have to credit my colleague Todd Clear for this concept of addiction to punishment or addiction to incarceration. If you think about it, it's like a physical addiction. You know, we try it, it makes us feel good. We feel like we're doing something about the addiction problem by locking people up. We continue to do it, but as with a physical addiction, you need a little bit more. So we increase sentences and we pass all kinds of laws to lock more people up for longer periods of time. And ultimately, we find out we're hooked. And we want to stop, we want to lessen our use, and we're unable to because we really have this addiction. And the result of this addiction, as Ben talked about some of the numbers, prisons, jails, and probation and parole have been expanding since the feds started keeping numbers on this in the 1980s. The Pew Center on the States report on adults under correctional supervision came up with a figure of 1 in 31 adults in the United States are under some sort of correctional supervision. 1 in 100 are actually behind bars. Okay. And there's a little, I guess, a glimmer of good news that growth in the correctional population has begun to slow and in the last year actually dropped a little bit. A little commercial for New Jersey and for New York. We are two states that have reduced our prison population significantly, 20% for New York and 19% for New Jersey. But it leaves the country with a huge problem. The cost of incarceration cost at a number of different levels. Now, some of the growth in the prison population is attributed to increased crime, and it, scholars have tried to untangle this Gordian knot of how much of the prison population was driven by crime, and they found that it's really a fairly small. Most of the increase in prison populations and probation and parole populations have been the result of policy changes and sentencing laws that have been passed to deal with largely with the increase in drug use. Bridget mentioned the famous Rockefeller drug laws. All of the states shifted in the 70s and early 80s to determinate sentencing. More people went in for longer periods of time. Some places abolished parole. Those that didn't abolish it made it harder to get out on parole. We had mandatory minimum sentences, three strikes laws, truth in sentencing, which generally was requiring people to serve 80. I think more disturbing than the cost of incarceration, of the financial cost, is the impact on our society of this strategy. So about the impact on individual offenders, their families, their children, on their neighborhoods. My colleague Todd Clear has written a wonderful book called Imprisoning Communities, where he looks at the impact of high incarceration rates on communities, particularly in urban areas. Our cities in New Jersey, the ones that I'm most familiar with, Camden and Newark, are just been torn apart by violence and gun violence and drug use. The cost to our states and the counties in terms of the straight head cost of operating prisons, that takes a lot of money away from other things that need our attention. The governor mentioned this morning, education. Some states are spending more on corrections. I think California is probably the prime example, and I'll pick on you, on the California folks. They spend more on corrections than they spend on higher education, which is a horrible situation to be in. And we also have this hidden cost of incarceration in terms of long-term debt. No one builds a prison for cash. They float a bond issue, and either the state or the county has to pay that off over time. So that debt service, again, continues to divert money away from things that we need to deal with, whether it's education, healthcare, or infrastructure, whatever it might happen to be. And then the other piece that I think we have to take into account is our failure to deal effectively with the drug problem in this country has effects on other countries and the quality of life in other countries. You look at Mexico. New York Times has run a couple pieces recently about the violence in Mexico. They're arguing about what the numbers are, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 45,000 people have been killed as a consequence of the drug violence in Mexico, which we all know is feeding the addicts in this country. So they've destroyed some cities in terms of their police departments and other institutions of civil society. So we've got to find a way, and this is my judgment, to break our addiction to punishment and to incarceration as a way of dealing with this problem.
Thank you very much. First question to you, Ms. Brenna. I'm mindful of Dr. Muhammad's comments earlier, where he talked about this racial component, which is part of the program today. Do you see it that clearly? Is race a part of the problem? Is it class?
Well, race certainly is visible when you look at the different addictions that we faced. Right now, we're looking at prescription pain medication addiction as being one of our big problems. We've initiated a number of prosecutions in that regard. What we're finding is that addiction is more prevalent among the middle class and white. And when we make our arrests, you know, we are arresting middle class white people in connection with that. The crack era, the issues were more concentrated in communities of color. And again, most of the defendants that we arrested, the law enforcement strategy was sort of a flood the zone strategy in order to tamp down the escalating violence. And most of the defendants we arrested in connection with that crisis were black. Heroin was a whole different thing. Again, the addiction was centered in the minority communities, the addiction now. I'm not talking about just straight drug use. And again, that at the highest level, there was organized crime, but the second level down tended to be black organizations. And again, that's where the arrests were focused. So there is that racial component, and that's the way I see it. Because remember, I'm in law enforcement, so I'm always on the back end of the problem. I see it as it lays out in terms of a criminal case, not affirmatively when you're on the cusp of an addiction issue.
Okay. You talked earlier about this program that you have, this alternative to incarceration involving, I think, women?
Yes.
How successful was it?
That was one of our most successful programs. We started that in the 80s with crack mothers. And the incentive there, these were women who were selling drugs basically to support their own habit. But they also had families. So there were two incentives they had. Number one, they wanted to stay out of prison because they were facing a mandatory prison sentence. But secondly, they wanted to get their families back together. And that was a huge motivation for them. And we were able to work with rehabilitation providers who facilitated the reuniting of families. And so I would say that was one of the most successful programs we've ever run, where there was a long-term great recidivism outcome, and we were able to bring a lot of families together. We had a very high success rate in that program.
So if it's successful, can you expand it to other areas?
Well, we did. That was the beginning nugget of the whole, we were in the very beginnings of that era of those programs, along with Miami started those programs, the Kings County, the Brooklyn DA's office did, and they were expanded to different groups. And most recently in the drug law revisions here in New York, the judges were put in charge of most of those programs. The flip side of it is, in New York, the incarceration rate has gone way down. Last year, I think 9 prisons closed. Since 2009, there have been 12 prisons closing. But the other thing that's happened is that the penalties for drug crimes have come down. And so for an alternative to incarceration program to have an impetus to change, the defendants generally have to be facing incarceration. What we're finding now is that on many of the defendants who previously were facing incarceration for selling drugs are not now. So the very serious cocaine and heroin addicts are not opting to get into the treatment programs. We're seeing more offenders who are selling crack maybe and report their addiction is to marijuana. So we're not seeing as many of those hardcore addicts. I just looked at the stats from the state couple of days ago, and I think about 50% of those in the state diversion program are marijuana addicts.
Okay.
Committed felony drug sales or other felony crimes, but they're marijuana addicts.
Bridget raised an issue that is a hot topic in the field of corrections, community corrections particularly, and that's incentives, behavioral incentives. She talked about how the crack mothers had two powerful incentives. One is to stay out of prison, the other is to get their family back together. What we're learning is if we want to change behavior, which is what we need to deal with when, with addicted offenders, we have to balance the carrots and sticks. We've been real good in the criminal justice system with sticks, big, heavy sticks, pounding people over the head, locking them up for long periods of time, taking away all kinds of rights and privileges. And we've kind of forgotten about the idea that human behavior changes through rewards and reinforcements and incentives. So we have to retool the system a little bit to think about how can we provide incentives for addicted offenders to get into treatment, stay into treatment, get their life back together, and build those into the supervision process, into the criminal case processing system, into the paroling system in the United States. So we recognize that we're dealing with human beings and human behavior, and the way you change them is not just by punishment. We all know that from our own lives, our own experiences, that what changes with our behavior is rewards, incentives, and reinforcements.
Bill, as I hear you make those comments, I look at the audience, people are nodding their heads. I'm thinking if we were in Texas, if we were in Mississippi, if we were in Indiana, there may not be as much head nodding in agreement to what you said. So, Bill, Mr. Tucker, what is the political reality of all this? There are certain parts of the country where people believe incarceration is the only answer. So how do you sell this nationally?
It's a great question. I think it's been said before, but I think in terms of the political reality, I think the fact of the matter is that there are lots of people in this country who have different perspectives about how to deal with the problem. And so, but in terms of addressing it in a way that makes it more effective, and you use Texas as one example, the governor cited Texas as well. Jeremy mentioned Texas. I mean, it's probably the most unlikely place in the country where you would think that the legislature and the governor would be thinking about, or particularly the legislature would be thinking about shutting down prisons, closing jails, and reinvesting some of those funds to deal with and fund treatment alternatives and so forth. And so that's really the reality. We know that that we can't continue to do business as usual. It hasn't worked. Prisons are full. From the time we started building those prisons and back in the 80s, and so we're sort of, you know, we've put ourselves in a position where we now have to think differently about approaches. And we also have on our side, and I think as to our advantage, are the programs that Jeremy referenced with respect to David Kennedy's approaches and Mark Kleinman's approaches, and this notion that and it plays out in programs like HOPE, where we start to look at ways to hold offenders accountable, but doing it in such a way that it's not really with a sledgehammer, but rather with some opportunity to say, hey, you had a dirty urine, you're going to jail for 2 days. It's swift. And it's certain, but it's modest in terms of its impact. And the hope is that you change people's behaviors. And in terms of the Hawaii program, that seems to be what has happened. And they've gotten dramatic and positive results.
Dr. Muhammad, when you hear someone from the White House talk about alternatives, we have a prosecutor here from the city of New York talking about alternatives. That just must make you feel warm and fuzzy to think that things are getting better and that we've turned the corner. Yes?
Sure. The fewer people that go to prison, the better off we all are. I mean, if we haven't learned anything, we should know that in the 21st century. Let me give an example. I'm a historian, so few of us talked about a background. My interest is what can we learn about the past that we've either forgotten or didn't pay much attention to. So you're going to hear a lot of history from me. That's what I'm here for. Most of us know something about Prohibition. It's one of the most glamorized and sensationalized moments in American history around crime. And there seems to be no endless appetite for the anti-hero as a kind of folk hero. And so you think of Robin Hood, you think of Bonnie and Clyde, you think of Don Dillinger, you think of this sort of fascination with the anti-hero. And I want to caution you that ought to be your first entry point to understanding what is a counterintuitive problem in America, which is to say, when the face of the problem looks like the people who are the majority population, they tend to enter the problem with much more compassion, sympathy, curiosity, And in this case, the prohibition experiment is much like the war on drugs. The scale of the issue was national in focus, prompting a constitutional amendment. All of you know this, and I would even argue a lot of the statistics we've talked about here, so bear with me in the recitation of what we know. And that, this comes back to the alternatives to incarceration. So here we have this moment where all of the evidence of the early 20th century points to alcohol as the greatest scourge in modern civilization. So it's contributing to fatherlessness, it's contributing to poverty, it's contributing to joblessness. Children are growing up to abusive fathers, and society is unraveling, particularly within its urban cores. Enter the problem of immigration, so you've got rising populations of people who aren't quite assimilated, who are stigmatized for having a foreign language. And what is the country to do in its urban population, particularly in the interest of its children? All of this is the context that brings about prohibition. Well, once we criminalize the manufacture and distribution of alcohol, it creates a massive underground economy. And all the incentives for a population of young men, again, not all of ethnic origin, but many of which. I mean, one of the fascinating things about prohibition is it wasn't just the Italians, it wasn't just the Irish, it wasn't just the Polish, it wasn't just the Jews. It was the native-born whites and a sprinkling of African-Americans. So it was a kind of melting pot of an underground economy. That being said, you get this, all the incentives move in the direction of young men who are already on the margins of our economic system, who are, in a sense, the lowest paid and least secure economic workers in the economy. And so they jump headlong into this underground economy. The price of whiskey, for example, increases five times between 1913 and 1928. Again, most of you know this in somewhere in your sort of cultural mindset, what happens in prohibition. But what you don't know is that New York State pioneered a series of laws beginning in 1926. It was really the beginning of the infrastructure of data as a basis for making sound criminal justice decisions in order to study the system and figure out how to improve it. And there was a larger cultural context where people felt like criminals were literally getting away with murder. So at the highest level, the bootlegging kingpins were, you know, not prosecutable, either because there was not good evidence to stick with them or because they had wily lawyers who kept getting them off. And so the New York Times is constantly editorializing how the modern professional criminal is literally getting away with murder. So these crime commissions, including New York State, which pioneers its own in 1926, pass omnibus legislation to enhance felony punishments for repeat offenders. So they figured if they could prove that someone had a prior felony offense, they could enhance the punishment for them so that someone who really did get caught with something wouldn't just get a minor offense. The second was they enhanced penalties for crimes committed with vehicles. Automobiles were fairly new at that time, and handgun possession because the police were literally being outgunned in some instances. Finally, and this is the most telling one in this instance, they made a mandatory four strikes provision for anyone caught convicted for a fourth felony. And it was considered draconian at the time, but it went into effect on July 1st, 1926. Almost overnight, judges in the New York State system, prosecutors were scratching their heads saying, I've got a bunch of low-level people coming before the bench convicted of low-level burglaries or grand theft auto, and they're facing life in prison. No one liked it in terms of the criminal justice system. Juries are nullifying verdicts, and what you get is a system where the face of victimization in this construct is a white face. But guess what happens? The stock market crashes 3 years later, and now all of a sudden you've got an economic dimension to the problem. So it now looks like basically poor people who are already marginalized, who resort to either participation in an underground economy at a low level, or who are committing crimes of poverty to survive, are being victimized and literally thrown in prison for the rest of their lives. No possibility of parole. By the early 1930s, the Crime Commission is on its heels and is trying to figure out, well, how can we defend this? One way that they defend it is they reclassify burglary as a violent crime. Because at this point, they've got to make the association between these draconian laws, which are targeting small fry property criminals or people who are addicted to drugs, or in this case, alcohol, as opposed to the modern gangsters, the drug kingpins, which I would argue forms the context for our modern war on drugs, right? It's those bad drug dealers that we ought to be focusing on as opposed to the users. Now, we've moved a long way from the 1980s to the present. What happens? By 1932, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, governor of New York, calls for amendments by the state legislature. They repeal the four strikes provision, and they basically enter an era of focusing on rehabilitation. They improve the quality of life in New York State prisons. New York State prisons between 1929 and 32 go through a series of riots as a result of increasing prison population. I call it the first period of mass incarceration. The difference is, though, it lasts this long. It lasts from 1926 till about 1932. And it's so telling because basically the face of the crime is a white working class ethnic face. And so people are looking at the system and saying, this system, the people involved in the system are too big to fail. We can't lock up a whole generation. So when we talk about the modern federal response to flooding the zone, well, you can flood a zone in a minority population in a particular neighborhood, but what happens when the entire nation is facing an alcohol addiction problem? We know to this day that alcohol is as addictive as marijuana, which accounts for 50% of drug arrests between 1990 and 02. And we also know that alcohol-related deaths are far higher than all narcotics combined, which is to say, how are we then to explain the repeal of prohibition in the 1930s to regulate America's most addictive pastime, which is alcohol consumption, if we're not to understand the relationship between a majority population participating in an underground economy or an addiction problem as opposed to a minority one? So in terms of alternatives to incarceration, the lesson there is the country first victimized people who were alcohol addicted or bootleggers who were involved in alcohol or all of the small players. Then it decriminalized participation by repealing first the harsh laws that came about because of prohibition, and then they repealed prohibition. And finally, they entered the long era of rehabilitation between the 1920s and the 1970s. Rehabilitation had begun in an early period, but it was intensified because this blip, which was prohibition, occurred right at the moment where the groundwork for rehabilitation ensued. Now we live with a system that incapacitates people and has built an entire legal code, both at the federal and state level, to effectively withhold rehabilitative support in the interest of being more punitive. And I would argue that has less to do with the people at this table and more to do with the politicians who have been pursuing elective offices on the basis of being tough on crime and not coddling people behind prison. But because those people represent a despised and marginalized community of people at the national level, it's very easy to gain political favor in this country by doing that, as opposed to if it was a majority white population of people being behind bars. And I will end with this. I won't have anything more to say, Brian, because I know I'm over time. You all have to wrestle with the fundamental fact that all federal self-report data on drug consumption suggests that across all racial categories, people use and consume drugs at the same rates, whereas most of the phenomenal and exponential growth in incarceration over the past 30 years has fallen in some states 80 to 90% on black or brown people. So you put those two things together and you figure out how different we are today than our predecessors were in the 1920s. Thank you.
Actually my first response would have been, preach it, Reverend Dr. Bishop Muhammad. Deacon Burrell, you wanted a response.
Well, that's the first time I've ever been to all that, I'll tell you that. I want to take advantage of the opportunity with a room full of journalists to raise an issue that has been driving me crazy for a long time. And the comments about the elected officials being behind these policies is at the heart of the matter. A lot of elected officials assume that the public has a very unified and unitary vision of crime and justice and punishment. Lock them up and throw away the key. The reality is the exact opposite. The public has a very sophisticated, nuanced view of crime and punishment. And you can look at the public opinion research on this going back for 30 years, and you're going to find that this is the result. They're not about locking everybody up. The people they're really scared of, the violent, chronic predatory offenders, yeah, lock them up. And we all kind of agree on that. That's not an issue. But they are very much supportive of the concept of rehabilitation for offenders, particularly for drug offenders. right? They realize that people have a problem, and they look at the correctional system as a mechanism where we should be helping people change their behavior, get back on track in society to be productive citizens. Former Governor Schwarzenegger, when he was elected, looked at the Department of Corrections and said, we need to have more correcting going on in the Department of Corrections. Right? So be careful when you hear from elected officials, my constituents want to lock everybody. That's not the case. All right? We need to be much more careful in terms of what we attribute to our fellow citizens in terms of their views on crime and punishment and how to deal with this problem. And the other issue for you all as journalists is to make sure you're giving balanced coverage to the successes of the justice system as well as its failures. A report just came out from Oregon where they looked at the correctional system there, like everybody else, trying to figure out how to save money. And like most other states, crime rates have been going down for a decade or more. Arrests are going down. Yet the people they surveyed as part of this commission had a feeling that crime was going up in their community. I said, wait a minute, all the numbers are going down. And the question to the governor before about, you know, is this just cops not arresting as many people? You got to look at the victimization surveys, which are unconnected to policing, and they've been going down. They match the FBI UCR data very, very well. All right. So crime has been going down. New York City is just, I don't know, it's the poster child here since like 1990. Incredible levels of reduction. Okay. But I think a lot of the media, you know, the old it bleeds, it leads, you know, they go after the sensational, the horrific, the crimes, and it's all over the news, the 24-hour cable networks, the blogosphere, wherever you want to find it. People get a disproportionate picture of crime in their communities. And be careful, I don't use this term, but it's journalistic terrorism. You're creating fear, unwarranted fear in the public by the way you're covering the question of crime in the communities, particularly in the cities. So be careful to not do that, but also to look at the successes. I mean, they're not as glamorous. They're not going to get you the 11 o'clock lead story on the news, but they are much more reflective of what's going on day in, day out in our probation departments, our parole agencies, our juvenile correctional facilities. Lots of people are making successful adjustments and changes. And I think that information needs to get out as well as the stuff that gets out, and it's going to continue. I think it's the nature of the beast. About the horrible crimes, but remember the public is very sophisticated in their view of punishment, very supportive of rehabilitation, and we need to make sure that message gets out so that elected officials don't have this knee-jerk reaction of lock everybody up. You look at nationally, lots of the states are changing their laws. Oklahoma's passing more laws to lock more people up. It just makes no sense. Sorry.
Please, you want to say something?
A couple of points. I often hear that statistic cited that use of drugs is equal among populations, and that's absolutely true. But as I have said, as I stated from the outset, we don't prosecute people for addiction. We prosecute people for the criminal activity that surrounds addiction. In regard to drugs, it tends to be drug sales. And what I have seen, in my office, we prosecute international cases, cartel cases. This is New York City. It's a hub of international trafficking. Most of our defendants in those cases are Spanish-speaking defendants. Why? Because the source country is in South America. Who ends up in prison tends to be the drug dealer. It's not the drug user. Certainly not incarcerated for long periods of time. And as long as I've got the microphone, let me also say that I hate the term war on drugs because I think it's cliche. It reflects a lack of understanding that we're dealing with a very nuanced issue. There's not just one addiction problem out there. There's not just one response. It's not one thing. We have to understand that this is a problem of many different dimensions. It presents itself in many different ways, and it needs to be treated differently depending on the drug issue that we're dealing with. So, a personal pet peeve, but having been once asked by somebody, how do you feel about being a drug warrior? I just don't think the concept is a well-informed concept.
Please, sir.
Yeah, just to Bridget's point, I would add, I mean, that's true. I agree 110%. And in fact, the administration's approach to this issue strikes that balance between law enforcement and public health. I mean, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact because this is such a complicated issue, you have to look at it from those different perspectives. And so, and I think we've typically focused on the law enforcement aspect of this over the years, but we now know that as we look at the impact and the cost, that $193 billion figure that I mentioned before, while $56 billion focuses on the criminal justice issues, the balance focuses on the public health issues and challenges that we face. And so we are, you know, as part of the reform effort, thinking about and looking to foster this whole notion of treatment and recovery. For the first time ever in a national drug control strategy, we started a recovery unit and a policy unit at ONDCP and have focused on this idea of treatment both in prisons, but also as well trying to facilitate and provide resources to jurisdictions across the country so that they can, as people leave prison, that lifeline continues to be available to them so that they can continue to get the services, the treatment services that they require if they're going to reenter in a way that has some value. And of course, that also has implications for, it's not just the treatment to that individual, but the effect that it has on the individual's family. And so we're talking housing, we're talking education, we're talking jobs, those kinds of things. So the goal is to try and sort of move in a direction that impacts those issues. The other thing I would mention is in terms of prevention, we're talking about, we talk a lot about addiction this morning, but we haven't talked about prevention in the context of realizing that it's really critical to keep our young people as much as we can away from drugs and to provide them with, you know.
Alan Minsky, KPFK Radio Los Angeles. I'm going to sort of stick my foot in it here because along the framings of Dr. Muhammad, part of the public sense of injustice around drugs and race issues is the free-floating notion that the largest cocaine market in the world is in Lower Manhattan in high-rise offices among traders. Okay? Now, in economics, there's a term called moral hazard, which applies, of course, again, to the traders in Midtown and Lower Manhattan. Or not, right.
Question, please,
right, well, basically, it does seem like a community that, I'm for all liberalization of drug rules, but it does seem to be a community that's begging for a stop and frisk. And what is the history of, seriously, the people in the country really think this is criminal if these guys get away with this. This has to do with the Mexican drug wars, it's the largest market. So what's the history of your department? What are the political pressures in our plutocracy as your inability to, you know, address the drug problems in Lower Manhattan among traders?
Let me just answer it this way. Number one, I have never received a phone call from a stockbroker saying, the guy next door is doing lines. Will you please come down and arrest him? Never heard it. However, weekly, every other day, in my office, we get calls from people who feel imprisoned by drug dealers in other communities who want the drug dealer off their street corner, that there's a line of people buying crack going in and out of the apartment next to them, that they don't feel safe. Remember, here, at least in the city now, we come to narcotics enforcement with the idea of keeping the city safe, not of stopping drug usage flat out. The law enforcement efforts are concentrated in place.
Yeah, my name is Jim Mulvaney. I'm a recovering journalist and I teach here at John Jay. as a state official, I joined in a program with the FBI targeting violent high schools, and it failed, and we immediately ratcheted it down to middle schools. And I'm interested in Mr. Tucker, what kind of discussions there are between DOJ and a better coordination with the Department of Education. The FBI and my agency found no reception to our anti-violence message in high schools where we did in middle schools.
Well, I'm not sure people faced began by getting left back in the second grade, third grade, and then by the time they were in the seventh grade or eighth grade, or should have been in the eighth or ninth grade, they were overage for grade and now started to sort of be disenfranchised from school. And there's a whole lot more that goes with that that I won't even go into now in terms of how they're treated by teachers and administration and so forth. And really kind of a lack of recognition about the fact that these youngsters have serious problems and need to be educated in a different way. So, you know, again, we think about it from the drug policy office, we recognize it's comprehensive. We recognize the need to work with the housing department, to work with the Department of Education, to work with all the federal agencies that have the ability to influence the impact at the local level, but then also to take it a step further and work with governors who are critical, and also local jurisdiction, mayors and so forth, sheriffs, and folks who have that local footprint.
Sure. A final question before we open up to the audience for questions. Can you give, I'm struck by, it doesn't seem a place yet where the four of you intersect on what the possible solutions may be. And you mentioned sort of building things to scale, right? And you talk about it's a nuanced problem, right? Talk about that, if you will, for a moment. And I'm also struck by, because part of our discussion today is supposed to be about race. And Dr. Muhammad has talked about race, but no one else, as best I can recall, from the panel has discussed that at all. Because how do you build it to scale if you don't deal with the issue of race? And if it's nuanced, is race part of that nuance?
Please. So I think, so I'm a historian, so we tell stories. So let me emphasize, it's not about preaching, right? It's about making compelling arguments of interpretation, because all of the data is subject to interpretation, no matter how it's presented. You know, we all live with political frameworks in our mind about how we receive information. I'm just put that as a caveat. I'm just more explicit in the stories that I'm telling. I appreciate, and this is because we have journalists in room, the caution about war on drugs. But I do want to have, I have two responses. One, I want to say that law enforcement is incentivized not to overemphasize that they are committing a war against its own citizens, right? I mean, wars are historically about the other, about the foreign invader, about the enemy. And so it would make any person in a sort of context trying to defend a set of policies that they don't like a war on drugs. But the fact of the matter is that a war was initiated at the highest offices of the land, in governor's offices, in state officials' offices, at the presidential level. It's a point of fact. It's not, you know, we could debate it, but it's a point of fact. I'd also like to say language is powerful. And so I don't like the term crack mothers, because the euphemism not only elides the fact that the highest number of crack users in this country are actually white. Disproportionately black people consume crack, but if you walk around the country talking about crack mothers, everybody's mind's eye is going to go to a black person from the 1980s, when in fact you can find many white crack users all over the country. And in fact, if you line them all up in a lineup, there'd be more of them than there would of black people. So I'm very, very concerned about how we use certain language to criminalize populations, and that's also a media invention. The media plays a part in its shorthand, glib references to how we talk about people. Finally, the war on drugs. Well, interestingly, if you are in communities of color in 2012 and you are subject to stop and frisk policies by the New York Police Department, where now as many as 700,000 people are estimated to be stopped and frisked, and almost 90% of them are people of color, you would feel perhaps like it was a war on drugs when the hit rate is roughly 6%, and actually 54,000 marijuana arrests last year for people who may have been dealers, may not have been, but they had some amount of marijuana which could fit in some part of their body, which could not have been, you know, a suitcase worth of marijuana, suggests that the line separating users and dealers is very thin and porous, and also should caution you as journalists to not accept that there's a clear distinction between those two categories of people. So for those 54,000 people, who most of whom would probably defend themselves as users, would say they do feel like they're involved in a war on drugs.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Keep it brief. I want to thank you for enlightening me with regard to language. I think you raise a very good point with regard to how we speak about these issues, and I hope you will take my comments regarding the use of the terminology war on drugs the same way. The concept was created by President Nixon more than 50 years ago. A lot has happened since then. We are not in the same place as we were then. What I see is a problem that has very many different dimensions. To the extent you call it a war on drugs, you cliche it. And so I don't think that helps us get towards a solution. When I say I think it is a nuanced problem, it requires a nuanced solution, a solution that's some law enforcement, that's some public health, and that is a huge amount community involvement, community support, it's education, it's providing opportunities. What's the best way to keep kids from dealing drugs? Give them something better to do. Give them better opportunities, make them believe that if they stay in school, they really are going to get a job, that they'll be treated respectfully. All those things are true. And I think all those elements need to be part of our efforts to solve this recurrent problem of addiction.
Thank you, ma'am. Open it to the audience for questions, please. Yes, sir.
To have brain scans. So has there been any studies done on the addictive brain?
There have been, through NIDA, the name Dr. Nora Volkoff may be familiar to some in the room, but she is a sort of preeminent physician that runs the National Institute of Drug Abuse, and she has run a number of studies, and just to be brief, I mean, she's discovered that indeed, not surprisingly, these drugs do impact all of our brains, but it certainly has a more difficult impact on and dangerous impact on our young people's brains, because they're not formed fully. Yes, yeah, and depending on the drugs, and so. The short answer is yes. Just to keep
we are out of time. Benjamin Tucker, William Burrell, Bridget Brennan, Dr. Khalil Muhammad, thank you all so much.